everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we'll be looking at some of the year's best non-fiction. Susanna Forrest shares the fascinating history of how horses helped to build our world.
What they definitely did was milk horses and use pretty much every part of their body.
I report from the Petworth Literary Festival and meet one of my heroes.
Reaching the summit of Everest was like an irritant, and I really wanted to get there.
And author and journalist Gary Young discusses another day in the death of America.
There is a mantra that the NRA have, that guns don't kill people, people kill people, which I've always thought was daft. It's a bit like toasters don't make toast, people make toast, but toasters exist to make toast and guns exist to kill things.
That's all coming up on today's Read On Air. My passion for novels sometimes leads me to forget just how many great non-fiction stories there are out there. This really hit home when I met author and journalist Susanna Forrest at the Wigtown Book Festival. Her latest book, The Age of the Horse, reveals just how integral horses have been in the history of human development and tells some fascinating stories along the way. I'd never realised, Susanna, that horses were originally domesticated fairly much as farm animals for milk and other products.
Yeah, there's a slightly gory history of us using lots of horse parts, but these people, the Botai in Kazakhstan in the Copper Age, which is about 3,500 BC, they seem to be the first people who tamed horses, at least, and they may have ridden them. It looks like they used bits, but what they definitely did was milk horses and use pretty much every part of their body to build houses. They used the dung, they used bones for tools, and they presumably used leather as well. So it was intensive from the beginning with domestication.
And I tend to think of horses as being used on farms to pull ploughs and help transport crops. That came somewhat later then?
Well, horses were used in agriculture, but they became sort of used intensively basically when ploughs and other equipment improved so much that they weren't so heavy that they needed oxen to pull them. And then horses became more and more commonplace at that point because they were 50% faster.
And when did they become the major form of transport for human beings?
Probably, I mean, it's the 19th century because people were just moving a lot more. A larger percentage of the population moved. The roads were better. Rail was invented and you needed horses to get to railways and get away from railways. And then within cities, quite soon, basically there were more horses in the cities than the country because they ran trams, buses, vans, cabs. You know, if you needed to get to the hospital, that was how you did it. Everything was done pretty much by horsepower after a while.
And of course, even when steam took over, horses have been used in mining and transportation.
Yeah, the last pit pony retired in Britain in 1997, I think. And some businesses converted to cars and vans and then converted back in the 1930s, actually, because there was still the manpower and the skill at that time, and it was cheaper to use horses. I spent time with organic farmers in America who were pointing out to me that if you have a farm under a certain size, and people knew this in the 1950s as well, under a certain size, it's more efficient to farm with horses for obvious reasons. You don't have any fuel costs, and you can replace one horse by getting it to produce a new horse. Whereas if you have a tractor, one farmer I talked to had started out with tractors, sold them, bought horses instead, and over 10 years he'd made a five-figure profit from the horses, whereas the tractor he would have just had to sell and then buy a brand new tractor. So it's instead of losing costs, you're actually making costs. So it's interesting that that's partly the reason people are going back to farming with horses in some places.
That's encouraging to hear. And of course, horses are also used in a therapeutic way as well.
Yeah, there's actually quite a long history of that. I mean, even I think Galen, who's the sort of Greek physician, recommended horse riding and chariot riding as a health activity. And then the 20th century, really riding people with disabilities, often war veterans, begin. So I talked a bit about side saddle earlier, and a lot of people who fought in the First World War and lost limbs used side saddles after the war to go riding. And they're still used in para dressage, for example. And I keep finding earlier and earlier examples of para riders long before the Paralympics. A woman riding up Oxford Street with no hands, or I think there was someone who had lost her sight who was hunting. Yeah, in the early 18th century, there's a very terrifying marchioness of Salisbury, I think, who, when she got very old and couldn't see anymore, she basically took out a groom on horseback who would tell her when the jumps were coming up and say, "Jump, my lady, damn it." So we kind of use horses' bodies as extensions and products in all kinds of ways, and they work sort of, I mean, the soldiers that I saw in the US who are working with horses had physical problems, part paralysis, but they also had problems with brain damage and traumatic stress disorder. And this sort of combination of the physical and the mental that you need with horses was very, very helpful for them.
And actually, I believe the UK has just got its first Falabella guide horse, but it's quite a big thing in the States, I understand.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of service horses in America, but I hadn't heard this about the Falabella in the UK, because they're magically tiny horses. I think probably a bit more biddable than Shetlands as well, if you're looking for a a guide horse.
My pony mad 15-year-old would be very happy if I got a Falabella. I must ask you to repeat the wonderful story of Morocco, the Elizabethan performing horse.
There were obviously all kinds of street performers across history working with horses, and he got particularly famous. I think he's mentioned by Shakespeare and Don. Morocco, he could count. He apparently climbed up St. Paul's Cathedral. That was one of the things, well, up the stairs, which was challenging enough for a horse. He could dance a jig and bow for the queen, and he could be sent out into the audience to pick out a certain person as well. There's supposedly a conversation that his owner got into with a bishop about whether there was witchcraft involved, and the horse solved this by bowing to the sign of a cross when his owner held it up. I also mentioned a less fortunate English performing horse who was supposedly burnt in Lisbon at the stake, basically. So Morocco, I think, survived, but not so all of these intelligent horses.
You came across a more modern case of a horse in Germany, where you now live, which might explain how Morocco did his marvellous magical tricks.
Yeah, this is the early 20th century, as a horse called Clever Hans. He literally lived about 10 minutes away from me. And his owner had trained a previous horse, but didn't get that far. And with this horse, he trained him. He could spell. He could do quite complicated sums. He seemed to be accumulating all kinds of knowledge. And what people eventually realized was happening was that it wasn't that he could count. He was basically watching his owner. So the owner would say, "What's 3 plus 4? Clever Hans would strike the ground 7 times, and then he would notice that his owner had relaxed, and then he would stop striking the ground. So he was a clever horse. You know, he was looking for these tiny, tiny signals, but he wasn't really doing quite what everybody thought he was doing.
Amazingly empathetic, though, for an animal to be that in tune with their human owner.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time we interact with horses, quite often horses in riding schools who have had a lot of conflicting signals and confusing signals from humans, so they're not that sensitive. So when you do come across a horse that hasn't lost that or that's been treated the right way by people, it's really fascinating because they are much, much more intelligent and intuitive and often interested in us than we give them credit. But we sometimes end up punishing them for the way that they are responding quite naturally to us. So it's a really interesting edge to horse care at the moment that people are trying to work out ways to teach people to interact with them in a way that doesn't confuse and shut down the horses.
Yes, no longer breaking in the horse, but working with the horse.
Yeah. And I mean, people are now getting quite radical with this and sort of letting the horse, like, explore the equipment and almost choose which equipment is used. And I'm impressed by people that can do that. I think you maybe need a lot of land and space. It's not something that people will be doing at urban riding schools in the near future, but it's interesting that they're doing it.
And finally, do you have a favourite horse story that you either came across in your research or a novel like Black Beauty that you read when you were a child that made you fall in love with horses?
Oh, yeah. It's almost impossible to do favourites, but because we're in Wigtown, I would mention a wonderful series of novels that influenced me a lot when I was a teenager and a child by a Scottish writer from Kilmalcolm, which I think is not that far away, called Patricia Leach. And they're kind of... people tend to dismiss pony books. They're like, oh, it's just girls and ponies and pony club. But these are really kind of about basically sort of Buddhist principles and big questions in life. And they're all set on the moorland around Kilmalcolm and partly also on Skye. I found the original of the house that's in the book. And they're really, really wonderful. And I would love to see them have a revival. I've just heard in the last month or so there is an audiobook of The Age of the Horse coming. It's an American publisher that's going to bring it out. So I'm hoping that will be available soon.
Fantastic. I shall look forward to hearing it. Susanna Forrest, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's lovely talking to you.
Thanks to Susanna Forrest. The Age of the Horse, An Equine Journey Through History, is out now in paperback, ebook, and as a commercial audiobook. And Patricia Leach's For Love of a Horse can be found in the RNIB Talking Books Library as TB19917. Do you have a favourite book or one that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair, that's all one word, at rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Chris Bonington on a life spent climbing mountains and Gary Young on American gun culture. But first, the Petworth Literary Festival is an annual gathering of the best in contemporary non-fiction. It's held amid the rolling Sussex countryside where I grew up, so it's a great excuse for me to see family and discover some great books. In the historic surroundings of Leconfield Hall, the festival's artistic director, Stuart Collins, took me through some of this year's highlights. So I grew up in the area and I know the charms of Petworth, but for those who don't, can you describe the town and a little bit of its history?
Yes, well, it's a very ancient town in the sense that we're dominated by Petworth House, which of course has been sitting there in various forms, I think, since about the 13th century, although I would hate people to go back and check their Wikipedias on that. But it's very much a town that where Petworth House sits in the middle, and then mushroomed around it are these beautiful little houses and cottages periods, most of them from 18th and 19th century. So it's very elegant. It's very small. There's a lovely little town centre. There's a lovely town square. And there are a lot of antique shops, which typifies the town, which makes it quite unusual. So it's a beautiful little town. And the great thing about it is that it's not on a major route to or from anywhere. So although there is traffic, and of course there's traffic everywhere, and then traffic's annoying everywhere, but at least there's not a huge road. We don't need a bypass, you know, that sort of thing.
And certainly in amongst those antique shops, as a little boy, I spent an awful lot of time poking around second-hand bookshops. And you still have a wonderful new bookshop here, and a fair amount of second-hand books too, I believe.
That's right. Well, I think in terms of the bookshop itself, the Petworth Bookshop, whenever people come to speak at the Literary Festival, one of the things they are at pains to say is, it is wonderful that you have an established independent bookshop here that is thriving. Support it, be grateful that they're there, don't let it go, because it's one of the kind of precious things that makes a town a town and gives an extra facility to the community. So we're very proud at the festival to be working with it and enjoy a very good relationship with them. But yes, it is a centre of antiques and books, and that's lovely.
And it's that love that has helped the festival grow. How long has the festival been going for now?
The festival started 7 years ago, but it's a sort of rib that was born out of Petworth Music Festival, the Petworth Festival itself, which happens each summer. But as I say, back in, I think it was 2011, we thought that the town was ripe for this extra literary week in the autumn. And it started off as 3 days. And this year it's expanded to 6 and is growing, growing, growing. So, you know, that instinct that there was a thirst for a literary festival was right. And we've had some fantastic events. And as I say, there's every reason to think it'll extend even further next year.
And you've had some wonderful guests in past years and again this year. Could you tell us some of the names who've come and spoken here in the past?
Well, I mean, this week alone, and my memory fails me for previous years because I'm very much living in the present, but we started with Jeremy Vine, who was obviously talking about his life as in Radio 2, essentially. And then we had Anne Widdecombe telling her tale, which is very sparkling, very, very entertaining, and obviously very direct. We had the Reverend Richard Coles, who everybody knows from Saturday Live. And today, you know, we have got the great Chris Bonington, the architectural journalist Simon Jenkins, the historical biographer Craig Brown. So some very, very, very well-known names. Victoria Hislop was here last year on the fiction side. So, yes, we've been very, very lucky. Michael Palin, you know, I could keep going.
And, of course, Gary Young as well, who I had the great pleasure of interviewing.
I look forward to hearing that because his talk was very, very sobering, but brilliant, and that's the way the journalists are. The idea to take an idea, sum it up in a book, but then at a literary festival to be able to express the main arguments very eloquently and tellingly. And Gary was terrific, and it was, you know, it's the kind of he's talking about, obviously, the death toll in America from gun crime, which is shocking, but it was a great illumination of that subject.
And that, of course, is one of the great joys of a literary festival, that even if your reading matter tends to be fiction, your mind can be opened to all the other genres around, and you can be tempted by history, architecture, or current affairs.
Well, that's right. That's a very interesting point you make, because I think most of us read more fiction than non-fiction. I think we're drawn to the story. But actually, the literary festival is better suited to the observer, the historian, the journalist, because if you haven't read a piece of fiction, it's quite hard for an author to talk about it. Obviously, it's very nice to come and see a very well-known fiction writer, but in the majority of events we have are with journalists, broadcasters, academics, talking about specific subjects which members of the audience will already have some understanding of. We had Jim Al-Khalili from Radio 4, and, you know, Professor Jim Al-Khalili, he of the popular scientist. And again, that was a subject that all of us are interested in, have some grasp of, and he was a wonderful, wonderful tutor for the hour. But so I tend to prefer to invite non-fiction writers for that reason.
Well, it's a wonderful and very accessible festival, and I know that you have to dash off, and Professor Chris Bonington, as do I. So, Stuart Collins, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On Air.
Enormous pleasure, and I look forward to listening to what Chris has to say and what Gary has to say. Thank you.
So, with no further ado, Sir Chris Bonington is a world-famous pioneering climber and mountaineer. In a career spanning 7 decades to date, he became the first Briton to climb the north face of the Eiger, summited Everest aged 50, led numerous expeditions to seemingly impregnable peaks, and is still climbing aged 83. He's written extensively about his adventures in books such as Annapurna South Face and Everest the Hard Way. He records the challenges of mounting expeditions to achieve the impossible. And in autobiographical works such as I Chose to Climb, he explores the personal side of the path that he has chosen, including its many tragedies. Now he's brought those twin lines together in his new book, Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge. Keen to find out more, I caught up with him at the Petworth Festival. But first, a clip from the audiobook.
How far are our personalities and the course of our lives shaped by the genes we inherit, and how far by the environment in which we are brought up? I rather think it's a combination of the two. But with our genetic makeup, having a very strong influence and those traits becoming visible from a young age. Looking back at my immediate ancestors, quite a few of them were undoubtedly adventurous in a variety of ways. They weren't great explorers or sportspeople, but they carved out a distinct life of their own. On my mother's side, my grandmother, whom I knew as Nan, and who played a major part in my early upbringing, was brought up a Catholic, the 10th child of a family of 12. Her father, Timothy Doran, was born in 1814 in Enniscorthy, County Wexford, went to Sydney as a young man, attracted by stories of fortunes to be made from the gold rush that started around that time. Until the gold rush, the majority of migrants had been convicts. For Timothy, it was a step into the unknown, starting with the horrendous 4-month voyage in a cramped sailing ship around the Cape of Good Hope and across the empty southern Indian Ocean, battened down in the hold for days on end, drinking brackish water and eating weevil-infested food. He spent 20 years in Australia, but didn't talk about it. Only scraps of family legend persisted. He spent most of his time in Sydney, but ventured out to the lawless goldfields, where if he saw a shadow fall across his tent, he shot first, and only then went out to investigate.
Gordon Griffin reading the audible version of Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge, by my guest, Sir Chris Bonington. One thing I was really struck by in Ascent is just how much climbing is a matter of relationships, whether that's on the mountainside at home or with your sponsors.
Well, totally. I mean, the key relationships are the friendships you make in the mountains and with the people you climb, either in this country or in the Himalayas. But also, yes, your sponsors and, of course, the link at home and the support you get from home.
And the group of climbers that you were climbing with in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they really were pushing the envelope of what was possible at the time. Do you think we will ever see the like of that kind of pioneering climbing again?
I think my generation was incredibly lucky coming into adulthood immediately after the Second World War, when so much was still to be done. I mean, in fact, no 8,000 metre peaks have been climbed until, of course, Maurice Herzog reached the top of Annapurna. And so that there are a lot of big, obvious, exciting challenges to make. I think the problem that the modern climber has is that there are less obvious kind of challenges. They're climbing at an incredible high degree, but the general public and the media can't really get their heads around it.
and actually the things, the achievements that reach the public attention may not necessarily be the most impressive extreme climbs that are being done at the moment.
Well, yes, I mean, one of the problems is that firstly, they can't really get Everest out of their minds. And Everest is, you know, it's just endless stories of crowds going up the mountains and unfortunate disasters, while the real climbers are quietly getting on with doing a lot of very, very hard climbs.
As you say in the book, when you reached the summit of Everest in 1985, you had it pretty much to yourself. How do you feel about the hundreds of people going up in a line to the summit of Everest nowadays?
Well, thank God I managed to get up it before they allowed that to happen. I think it was inevitable, and I don't really begrudge it, because each one of those people, who a lot of them are comparatively inexperienced, but have forked out between $25,000 and $60,000 for the privilege of getting to the top of the mountain. But it is a huge experience in their lives. And what do you do? Do you ration it, in which case less people are going to be able to do it, or maybe only the very rich can do it? Or do you let it happen as it is? Where, yeah, a lot of people find that pleasure and excitement. And as far as people like myself go, if you want to have the mountains yourselves, there's still thousands of unclimbed peaks in the Himalayas.
I know reaching the summit of Everest was a major landmark for you. I wonder, was that your favourite climb? Do you have a favourite achievement?
No, I think reaching the summit of Everest was like an irritant. And I really wanted to get there. And I didn't realise just how important it was until I did get there. And then it was kind of, thank God I've got that out of the way. And after 85 and since then, I've had a whole series of exploratory expeditions, some of them quite zany expeditions, and all of them great fun.
And, of course, one of the most recent was climbing the Old Man of Hoy, aged 80. What led you to do that?
Well, it was primarily a great friend of mine, Leo Holding's idea. Leo Holding, he's one of our athletes. I'm chairman of Berghaus, which does outdoors clothing. And Leo said, well, look, why don't you come and do the Old Man of Hoy when you're 80? I'm the youngest person to have done it. He was 11 when he was taken up by his dad. And it meant a hell of a lot to me. It was a struggle to get up, but it was also for me a kind of almost a catharsis that helped me after the loss of my wife.
And of course, you raised funds and awareness about motor neurone disease, which was clearly very important to you in that process too.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, it's a horrible disease, and so little is known about it. It's incurable. And so the more funds one can actually raise to try to find a cure for motor neurone disease is hugely worthwhile.
Your account of climbing the Old Man of Hoy in I Chose to Climb stuck with me and is why I climbed it myself. And so I Chose to Climb has long been one of my favourite books. Do you have a favourite climbing book?
I would say actually The White Spider was an inspiration to me. Even earlier than that, W.H. Murray's Mountaineering in Scotland. And that was when I read that in the early 1950s. Really, the Alps and the Eiger and Everest and everything else was beyond my reach. But the wilds of Scotland were within my reach. And that really inspired me.
And finally, would you prefer to be on rock or on ice?
I love both. They're different. I think for sheer sensual pleasure, though, when you're climbing at your peak, there's nothing like really good rock climbing when you're pushing the limits.
I couldn't agree more. So, Chris Bonington, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On Air.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
The White Spider. The Story of the North Face of the Eiger by Heinrich Harrer. The spider on the Eiger's face is white. Its body consists of ice and eternal snow. Its legs and its predatory arms, all hundreds of feet long, are white too. From that perpetual, fearfully steep field of frozen snow, nothing but ice emerges to fill gullies, cracks and crevices. Up and down, to left, to right, in every direction, at every angle of steepness. and there the spider waits. Every climber who picks his way up the north face of the Eiger has to cross it. There is no way around it. And even those who moved best and most swiftly up the face have met their toughest ordeal on the spider. Someone once compared the whole face to a gigantic spider's web, catching the spider's victims and feeding them to her. This comparison is unfounded, exaggerated, and merely a cheap way of making the flesh creep. Neither the savage wall nor the lovely mountain have deserved this slur. Nor have the climbers, for climbers are not flies and insects stumbling blindly to their fate, but men of vision and courage. All the same, the white spider seems to me to be a good symbol for the north face. The climber has to face its perils on the final third of the wall, when he's tired from many hours and days of exhausting climbing and weakened by chilly bivouacs. But there is no rest to be had there, no matter how tired you are. He who wishes to survive the spate of avalanches which sweep the spider must realize that there is no escape from this dangerously steep obstacle. He must know how to blend his strength with patience and reflection. Above the spider begin the overhanging iced-up exit cracks. That is where sheer strength tells. But here, the man who abandons patience and good sense for fear-induced haste will surely finish up like the fly, which struggles so long in the spider's web that it is caught through sheer exhaustion.
A clip from The White Spider, the story of the north face of the Eiger, written by Heinrich Hara and narrated by Philip Bretherton, which is available as TB18839. And they say you should never meet your heroes. Several of Chris Bonington's books are available from the RNIB library in a variety of accessible formats, including I Chose to Climb, which is TB5877, and Annapurna South Face, which is TB1646. Let's hope Ascent joins them there soon.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
The following interview contains subject matter not suitable for family listening.
Gary Young is an award-winning author and journalist. As editor-at-large for The Guardian, he spent much of the last decade reporting from the United States, first from New York and then Chicago. His latest book, Another Day in the Death of America, is a thought-provoking and heartbreaking exploration of America's gun culture and its impact on that nation's youth.
The most common adjective employed by weather reporters on Saturday, the 23rd of November, 2013, was treacherous. But in reality, there was not a hint of betrayal about it. The day was every bit as foul as one would expect the week before Thanksgiving. A Nordic outbreak of snow, rain, and high winds barreled through the desert states and northern plains towards the Midwest, with warnings of a 500-mile tornado corridor stretching north and east from Mississippi. The weather alone killed more than a dozen people, and as the low front shifted eastwards, so did the threat to the busiest travel period of the year, bringing chaos so predictable and familiar that it has provided the plotline for many a seasonal movie. There was precious little in the news to distract anyone from these inclement conditions. A poll that day showed President Barack Obama suffering his lowest approval ratings for several years. That night, he announced a tentative deal with Iran over its nuclear program. Republican Senate Minority Whip John Cornyn believed that the agreement, hammered out with six allies as well as Iran, was part of a broader conspiracy to divert the public gaze from the hapless rollout of the new healthcare website. Amazing what WH, White House, will do to distract attention from OCARE, he tweeted. Not surprisingly, another of the day's polls revealed that two-thirds of Americans thought the country was heading in the wrong direction. That night, Fox News was the most popular cable news channel. The Hunger Games' Catching Fire was the highest-grossing movie, and the college football game between Baylor and Oklahoma State was the most-watched program on television. It was just another day in America. And, as befits an unremarkable Saturday in America, 10 children and teens were killed by gunfire. Like the weather that day, none of them would make big news beyond their immediate locale because, like the weather, their deaths did not intrude on the accepted order of things but conform to it. So, in terms of what one might expect of a Saturday in America, there wasn't a hint of betrayal about this either. It's precisely the tally the nation has come to expect.
Damien Lynch narrating the talking book version of Another Day in the Death of America, whose author, Gary Young, joined me shortly before his appearance at the Petworth Festival. Gary, welcome to Read On Air.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who haven't read the book, could you give some background as to why you felt compelled to write it?
Yeah. The book is based on a very simple and gruesome statistic, which is that every day, on average, in America, 7 kids are shot dead, kids being 19 and under. And I'd lived in America by the time I started writing the book or researching the book for about 11 years. And during that time, wherever I was, either in New York or Chicago or on the road, I would, you know, you'd be watching TV and you would hear, you know, kind of just before the weather, you know, and on 18th and so, a young man was shot dead, blah, 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 thing of the grieving mother, usually, and then straight onto the weather or the sport. And when I found out that statistic, I thought, my God, this is going on all over the country all the time. And unless the shootings are mass shootings, which are understood as spectacles, really, like Sandy Hook or Aurora or Columbine or something like that, then these kids pass without anyone beyond their locale even knowing. And even in your locale, it's a few seconds on the news. So beyond their immediate community, it's not news. And it was one of those things, I think, as a journalist, I thought, you know, these kids have names and families and dreams and so on. I want to find out who these kids are. There's that journalistic adage, if a dog bites a man, that's not a story. If a man bites a dog, it's a story. But sometimes when things happen with such regularity, you have to ask yourself, who owns these dogs? And why do they keep biting people? And why do the same people keep getting bit? And there's a range of things that you can get used to that aren't normal. And this was one of them.
And certainly the way you frame the book, that you devote a chapter to each one of these young victims and you take us through the last day of their lives and give context to them. It's a very powerful way of introducing you to people who shouldn't have died that young. And in some ways, it's rather like a short story until you realise that that's a real life that's gone. And that happens every single day in the States.
Yeah. I mean, the structure of the book is that, so I pick a 24-hour period and I find all of the kids who were shot dead that day. And then I spend the next year and a half finding anyone who will talk to me about them, teachers, preachers, coaches, relatives. I go through their Facebook pages, their Twitter feeds, their Instagrams, any public records, arrest records, anything. To try and build a portrait of who these kids are. And in some ways, I mean, it's this curious thing, I'm not sure if you know, 6 Feet Under, the series, which is about an undertaker's, where every episode starts with a death. And so once you see the kid's name, each kid is a chapter, and once you see the kid's name, there is no suspense. You know that that child is going to die, and the youngest is 9 and the oldest is 19, just a few days off his 20th birthday. But then what you have is a portrait, I hope, for them of their life. And therefore, because it is such a random selection, because the day chose them, I didn't, you also get a sense of kind of American childhood and youth and its vulnerability, really.
And you caution against drawing stereotypes, painting these kids either as angels or demons. But I mean, it's quite shocking how so many of the killings are utterly random and in a couple of cases just little kids playing with guns.
Well, yeah. I mean, two of the kids are accidents. One is at a sleepover and the boy is showing his friend the gun and he said he got caught in his trouser pocket and blew his friend's head off. And the other one, two teenagers who live in an area run by the gangs. Her brother has been shot at by a rival, so she decides to get a gun, but they don't really know how guns work. They're playing with it, and they assume because the cartridge is out, the clip is out, they don't know that having cocked it, there's one in the chamber. And so, you know, she shoots her friend by accident. But yes, there's one boy who's wearing a red hoodie and has plaits, and there's a gang looking for a kid with a red hoodie and plaits, but it's not him. This is a mistaken identity. There's a boy who's driving a car with a gang member in it. He doesn't know that.
And a blind boy as well, and Pedro.
Yes, Pedro. There's a legally blind boy in San Jose, California, who was wearing red, I think, which is a gang colour where he lived. There was red and there was blue, and he's just taken out in a drive-by. Or it could even have been that his friend was wearing red, but that they're walking together. These kids aren't always great shots. And Pedro takes the bullet.
Another thing that I found truly shocking is just how demoralised and despairing many of the friends and family of the victims are. There's one father who says that, of course, he'd talk to his son about gun violence because where he comes from, you have to consider it as a possibility that your child might die in a gun attack.
Yeah, that's right. Gary Anderson in Newark. He says you're not doing your job as a black father in Newark if you don't think your child could be shot dead. Now, the racial complexion of this day is that seven of the kids are African-American, two are Latino, one is white, which is disproportionately black. And on an average day, three would be black, three would be white. One would be Latino, and every third day a Native American or Asian American would be rotated in there. And this was a random day, so there were no girls. Usually two of the seven would be girls. You know, it's not representative. But of the black kids who died, all of the parents that I spoke to, when you ask them, did you think this could happen? They all say, well, yes, they'd factored that in. They didn't want it to happen, obviously, but one mother, the mother of Samuel Brightman in Dallas, says, I didn't think it would be him. I thought it would be his brother. And there is this sense, particularly for working-class African-Americans, that if there was a super nanny for working-class black America, every edition would be, how do I get my child to adulthood without them getting him put in prison or shot dead? So one of the most heartbreaking quotes in the book to me was Tishon Anderson, a young man in Chicago who was shot in a stairwell. He was 18.
Shortly after Tishon's killing, a photographer for the picture agency Getty Images interviewed a mother who lived in the building where it happened. She was happy that her 14-year-old son was locked up, she told him, because it was safer for him to be incarcerated than to live in the neighbourhood.
And actually, Tyshawn's mother also says the one good thing about him being dead is that she no longer has to worry about him being involved in gun violence, which is just...
Well, yeah, a real desire, which I have in my journalism generally, not to succumb to the kind of crude morality plays of good and bad and the angels and demons, but to try and see the humanity in everyone, good or bad. Tishon was himself a killer. According to his godmother, she said he had bodies under his belt. And she said she'd been waiting for that call. She knew he'd been shot at before. She knew he wasn't going to make old bones. And so, to some extent, there was some relief in the fact that the call had now come and that she wouldn't have to wait for that call anymore.
I think it would surprise a lot of people to read in the book that this is not a book about gun control. It's a book about the issues surrounding poor, segregated America. Guns are just an additional toxic element in the cocktail.
That's right. I deliberately, which is, you know, counterintuitive for me, really, because I'm a columnist for The Guardian generally, or had been at the time. I very deliberately wanted to write a show book, not a tell book, not to tell people, well, this is what I think about guns and this is, you know, what you should think about guns.
just because the gun debate, if you can even call it that in America, is incredibly sterile. And also, who's going to listen to a Brit about guns in America? So there was that too. Look, this is what guns do. And there is a mantra that the NRA have, that guns don't kill people, people kill people, which I've always thought was daft. It's a bit like toasters don't make toast, people make toast. But toasters exist to make toast, and guns exist to kill things. And that once one looked at what they did, it became impossible to unpick it, really, from America's broader social pathologies. Poverty, racism, segregation, the kind of fact that really common sense laws, like a law that would say you will be breaking the law if you don't safely store your guns when there are children around. That laws like that can't get passed because Congress people are bought and sold by, you know, lobbying interests. The way that the media treats these deaths, the effect of kind of deindustrialization on the community, that all of these things, the gun is like the flammable kind of element on the top of a huge pile of tinder. Now, every country has this tinder. You know, I've been doing a project this year for The Guardian on knife deaths in Britain. There isn't a country that doesn't have some of these problems, but when you put the free and easy availability of lethal weapons on the top of that tinder, well, you know, things are going to kick off.
And that's what makes it a uniquely American problem. As you say, I certainly recognised a lot of the socioeconomic issues underlying the problems within society in general, but guns add that lethal element to it. And yet there seems to be an acceptance on one side, on the governing side, that it's acceptable collateral damage for the protection of the American dream, and on the other side, that it's self-protection against a violent society.
Well, that's right. I mean, in the absence of a different driving narrative or ethos, what guns generally produce is more guns. So if you take Sandy Hook, where the more than 20 children were shot dead, as well as Adam Lanza and several teachers in Connecticut. What happened as a result of Sandy Hook is not that there were less guns, but that Sandy Hook got armed guards. So the more fear there is, the more guns there are. The more guns there are, the more likely people are to get shot. The more frightened they are, the more guns there are.
I'd like to tell the listeners that actually it is whilst it's a heartbreaking book and a very upsetting book in many ways, it is very compelling, and it's an incredibly moving book about human spirit and human resilience, which actually has changed the way I listen to the news. And it's a very rare book that does that. And well, thank you.
Oh well, that's very kind of you to say that. I mean, it is. I remember saying to my wife about halfway through doing it, I don't care if nobody reads this now, I just really have to do it. You know, I really, it became a bit of a mission for me. And, you know, all books are a bit of a mission, but this was kind of, it felt like an excavation project of kind of uprooting these stories. And I do remember right at the beginning, when we picked the day and the day picked the characters. And as I was kind of working through their pen portraits, I said to my publisher at the time, so how do we just make this not a tale of never-ending woe? And she said, well, it's going to be in the stories, isn't it? It's going to be in the stories. All you know at the moment is how these kids died, and what you're going to find out is how they lived. And that was quite a focusing kind of mission, really, was, you know, these kids are more than their deaths. So who, how, and why, and what?
And you enable them to continue their lives after deaths by naming them rather than leaving them as statistics.
Well, I mean, that is also very kind of you to say so. That was the first child to die in the book, Jaden. I'm still very much in contact with his mum. And she is buoyed by the fact that his name is still out there. And when there was a translation query when the French edition came out, and I had to contact her to ask her a further question, and she was like, "God, so Jane's name's going to be in France, you know, and in Holland and in Italy," and that sense that he was still out there. And so recently, I think on Twitter, on his birthday, I did a shout out for him for his birthday and put a bit about his story out there, and people sent his mum, you know, birthday wishes and condolences to her, and it kind of, you know, it meant a lot to her.
Well, another day in the death of America, certainly for me, is proof that something good can come out of something as terrible as that statistic of how many children die each day from gun violence. And Gary Young, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the book.
Thank you.
Another Day in the Death of America by Gary Young is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB23682. Visit rniblibrary.com or ring the helpline on 0303 123 9999 for more information.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Stuart Collins for the books of his life. Stuart, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with books and authors?
This will sound very strange, and I suppose it's more of a reflection on my parents than myself, but I just remember being turned on to writing and to the storytelling and to sort of humour, in a way. Humour has been very central to what I enjoy. And I remember my parents introducing me to the Jennings books by Anthony Buckridge, all about young children in a preparatory school, which I didn't go to a preparatory school. I went to a junior mixed and infant school in East Barnet in North London. But I was fascinated by, and it was so funny, the larks that they had between them, the interplay between them, the mischief. And I just remember that as being a sort of, yeah, I want to be fun, mischievous, get my knees dirty, throw my cap in the pond, you know, all that sort of thing. So that weirdly is what I remember as being the sort of the first books that I really got into and wanted to read them all.
Ah, a new boy, eh? Said Mr. Carter. And what's your name? Jennings, sir. Oh, yes, here you are on the list. J.C.T. Jennings, 10 years, 2 months, right? No, sir. Not quite right, sir. 10 years, 2 months, and 3 days last Tuesday, sir. Ah, well, we won't worry about that, said Mr. Carter. He had placed the new boy by now. Only that morning the headmaster had shown him a letter from a Mr. Jennings, expressing doubts lest his son, who had never been away from home before, should not settle down at boarding school.
That takes me back. Andrew Timothy narrating Jennings Goes to School by Anthony Buckeridge, which is TB2419. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Oh, now that's slightly different to what I was going to say, because there's a book I'd like to curl up and read. So I hope you let me go with that, because I have long through my career, which has been some of it on stage, some of it as a festival organiser, I have always been absolutely obsessed by Shakespeare and the fact that this one man seemed to know everything, understood everything about the human being. He understood men, he understood women, he understood tragedy, he understood imagination, everything. But I'm going to jump one sideways because I want to read Cervantes, because he supposedly, this is what I'm told by my Spanish friends, does exactly the same, but in the Spanish language, and I haven't read it yet. So I want to read Don Quixote, I want to read his other works, again, to get that perspective on all things that we ought to know and understand, and to see that people have known them from time immemorial. So if I was going to reread, I'd reread Antony and Cleopatra, but I want to read Cervantes and Don Quixote.
It'll be a long, rainy day. Maybe after St. Swithin's.
The importance of the thing lies in obliging you to believe it, confess it, affirm it, swear it, and maintain it without seeing her. And therefore make this acknowledgement this very moment, or know that it is with me you must join in battle, ye proud and unreasonable mortals. Come one by one, as the laws of chivalry require, or all at once, according to the dishonourable practice of men of your stamp.
Don Quixote by Cervantes, which is TB 2230.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, interestingly, as I've been building up to the literary festival here, obviously what I have to do is read all the books of the authors who are coming, because I feel that that's my duty to make sure that if I have to lead questions. So basically we've over the period of 6 days, we've had about 20 authors talking about 20 books, which means I've just been, my last 3 months has been this fantastic pageant of reading. Now, which one would I recommend? I would actually recommend a book we were talking about at the festival yesterday called Gone. It's all about the young Korean violinist who had her Stradivarius violin stolen at Euston Station. You don't need to particularly love music, you don't need to understand music, but what this tells you, it's a story of loss, of tragedy to a certain extent, but also courage, fortitude, understanding, learning, and human strength. And I love those biographical tales. And we all have lows, we all have highs, we all have to find ways of getting through them. And this is a wonderful example. So by Min Kim, Gone.
Thanks to Stuart Collins and the organisers of the Petworth Festival. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, the titles you're enjoying, and your suggestions for books that I might like. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You can find a link at our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or just search for RNIB Radio. So, farewell until next week. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to read on.